June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples, breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus.
Isn't it crazy that America is turning 250 years old? I mean, look how far we've come. Now, we've got coolers in our sofas, light-up cup holders, and power-articulating headrests. When it comes to furniture worthy of this major milestone, Bob's Discount Furniture has all the styles all of America wants at the everyday low prices we deserve, backed by tons of five-star reviews. Check out the Sedona Power Reclining Sofa, a genuine leather one-stop shop for relaxation with built-in charging, cup holders, and supportive bobopedic seats, perfect for lounging in the AC all day. You can even complete the look with the matching love seat and recliner. Throwing summer parties? The HomeWorks dining set features comfy bobopedic seating and clever storage built right into the table and bench. Or customize your space with the customer favorite modular Bob Sectional. It has over 1,000 five-star reviews, family-proof construction, and wireless charging for hundreds less than the competition. At only $250 per piece, building your dream sectional is incredibly affordable. Celebrate the 4th at Bob's. It's where America shops for furniture.
When you think of a scientist, you probably picture someone in a white coat, tucked away in a lab, far from the public eye. But every once in a while, one of them breaks into the spotlight.
On a recent weekday afternoon, CNN offered free chicken wings to anyone who wanted them, if they filled out a brief survey about food. Helping us, Cornell professor Brian Wansink, author of Mindless Eating and a leading researcher on how people really behave around food.
In 2016, a social scientist named Brian Wansink brought a wave of positive attention to Cornell University. His research didn't just live in academic journals. It captivated the public. He was the guy who helped popularize the idea that eating from a smaller plate can make you feel fuller. But that same year, Wansink made a startling admission, one that would call his entire body of research into question and pull Cornell into the center of a growing crisis in the world of science. I'm Margot Gray. This week on Campus Files, the rise and fall of Brian Wansink's food and brand lab and what it reveals about the future of academic research.
The Brian Wansink story crossed my desk in the fall of 2016. Brian Wansink was a professor at Cornell University, and he ran a lab called the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. And it's basically studied eating behaviors and food marketing.
That's Stephanie Lee. In 2016, she was a science reporter at BuzzFeed News, covering exactly the kind of fascinating research that Brian Wansink's lab was known for.
His work was all about basically how you can lose weight without severe dieting or intense exercise. His overarching theory was that people could be nudged into making healthier eating decisions by just adjusting elements of their environment.
Weight loss is always a hot topic, And any science-backed strategy is almost guaranteed to generate media buzz. Brian's research was like catnip for TV audiences, especially since some of his findings were pretty wacky.
People who sit farthest from the front door at a restaurant eat fewer salads and are more likely to order dessert. Eat by a window or at a high top table, you're more likely to order salads there. If you want to drink less wine, choose a narrower wine glass versus a bigger one.
One of Brian's most famous studies involved what he called a bottomless bowl of soup. Here's how it worked. Everyone in the study was served soup. Some participants got regular bowls, while others unknowingly got bowls that secretly refilled themselves from underneath. The results were striking. People with the self-refilling bowls ate significantly more. And it supported Brian's idea that the more food you see in front of you, the more you're likely to eat. It was exactly the kind of quirky, attention-grabbing research his lab was known for. And Brian had a knack for getting the media to notice. So it's no surprise that his work also caught the attention of companies eager to turn those insights into profit.
I'm Dr. Brian Wansink from the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. You know, we've been doing a bunch of really cool supermarket psychology studies. One of the things we found is that if you have eye contact with something, even if somebody in a box, it looks more trustworthy and it increases your likelihood to purchase things.
All that research helped land him professorships at top institutions like the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Then, in 2005, he joined Cornell.
Brian was also really influential in policy. So from 2007 to 2009, he was the executive director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion. And that's the center that does the dietary guidelines for Americans.
Brian quickly became a valuable asset to Cornell. His work with the Department of Agriculture brought in millions in grant funding, and the media buzz around his research was icing on the cake.
Brian was a really high-profile figure. You know, every time the media quoted him, it was, you know, professor at Cornell University, and that's a great look for an Ivy League university. You got a scientist who is in the media all the time, who the media is interested in, who is influencing the real world with the work that's going on in his lab. That's kind of the ideal academic from a university's point of view.
Brian was at the top of his game. The Food and Brand Lab was turning out a steady stream of research. He was regularly appearing on TV, publishing books, even influencing public policy. So it's no surprise that his blog attracted plenty of attention too.
In the fall of 2016, Brian wrote a blog post on his website, and it was in praise of what he called the grad student who never said no.
In the post, Brian heaped praise on a grad student who'd spent time at the Cornell Food and Brand Lab on a visiting scholarship.
When she arrived, she was given a data set from an experiment that had been conducted before she got there. The original hypothesis had not worked out. Brian Wansink called it a failed experiment. Failed was his word. And he gave her the data set, this visiting student, and encouraged her to find something usable out of it. And he was very proud of the fact that she ended up publishing 5 papers out of this failed experiment.
It all sounded great until you looked a little closer. Hidden in plain sight was a surprising admission, one that most readers probably missed.
The problem that Brian's blog post raised was that he explicitly said the original hypothesis we were going to test failed, but we found all these other connections in the data. The problem is whether those were actually valid or not.
Think back to your high school science experiments. You always started with a hypothesis. You didn't look at the results first and then work backward to make a theory fit.
It is highly frowned upon to have a data set and you are kind of just running variables against each other and looking for statistical correlations that on paper seem high.
So why is that frowned upon? Because the whole point of starting with a hypothesis is to control for other variables. If you're testing how sleep affects productivity, for example, you'd want to factor out things like caffeine intake. Otherwise, the results don't mean much. Brian's original study was supposed to examine how the price of a buffet influenced people's food choices. But under his guidance, a grad student started slicing and reshaping the data to support entirely new hypotheses. One of them was that men eat more when they're dining with women. It's an eye-catching claim, and sure, it sounds plausible, but who's to say what other factors weren't accounted for? Maybe some of the men had worked out that morning and were just hungrier. That alone could throw off the results. Still, the finding was presented as if it met the usual standards of scientific rigor. And all of this was laid out, plainly, in a blog post by Brian. An admission that would ignite a nearly two-year saga. One that put Cornell's prestigious lab under intense scrutiny and threatened to end Brian's career. And simmering beneath the surface was a much larger crisis in the world of science. One that was about to make everything even messier.
Real skin results start with one daily ritual. Meet Daily Microfoliant from Dermalogica. This iconic exfoliating powder activates with water to gently polish away dullness and uneven texture. It leaves skin instantly smoother and more luminous while supporting your skin barrier. Formulated with professional expertise to deliver visible results daily, even on sensitive skin. Discover your healthiest skin today. Visit Dermalogica.com and use code SMOOTH at checkout for an exclusive gift with your $65 purchase.
Not all electric vehicles are designed the same. Toyota Electric is built to work for you. Grounded in years of proven engineering, it feels intuitive from the start. The Toyota BZ for smooth, everyday driving. The BZ Woodland for all-terrain capability. The all-new CHR for an instant, responsive drive. It's not just electric, it's Toyota Electric. We make it easy. Toyota, let's go places.
It's late 2016, and Brian Wansink seemingly admitted in a blog post that his lab had manipulated data. Unsurprisingly, his post quickly drew some attention.
I am a forensic meta scientist. That means I computationally study the results of other scientific papers, usually to determine whether or not they're accurate and honest.
James is part of an informal group of other forensic meta scientists. Here's another member of that group, Nick Brown.
I'm a retired computer guy, and I found myself increasingly interested in bad science and then in terrible science and then in essentially fraudulent science.
Nick and James share a mission, calling out bad science when they see it. They think of themselves as a kind of scientific watchdog, so much so that they've given themselves an Avenger-style nickname, the Data Thugs. At the time of Brian's blog post, the Data Thugs already had their hands full. The world of research was in the middle of a major crisis, something called the reproducibility crisis. It sounds technical, but the idea is simple. If one scientist runs an experiment, another should be able to do the same thing and get the same results. Take one of Brian's claims, for example, that men eat more when dining with women. If that's really the case, then repeating the experiment under the same conditions should lead to the same outcome. But by the early 2010s, researchers were discovering that wasn't always happening. Some of the most influential studies in psychology and medicine, including up to 80 to 90% of cancer research, couldn't be replicated. Entire fields were suddenly called into question, along with decades of follow-up studies and millions of dollars in funding. So when the Data Thugs came across Brian's blog post, they knew something wasn't right.
Everyone hit the roof because this was in the dead center of the kind of emotional part of the replication crisis. In the Kubler-Ross grief stages, everyone would have been in anger. And in the middle of having this very broad, increasingly organized skepticism towards the social sciences, this very famous, well-regarded guy had basically written a blog post about how he abused the research process.
Brian had, in effect, admitted to the very kind of scientific malpractice they were fighting against.
We got DMing. And we said, I wonder what his papers look like. And so we pulled some of his papers and started going through it using some of the very basic numerical analysis tools. I mean, they're sixth grade arithmetic, which enable you to look at some numbers in a paper and say, those can't possibly be right. That number can't be that number divided by this other number. Really as simple as that.
Right away, the data thugs found that some of the numbers in Brian's papers weren't just questionable. They were outright impossible.
And then we started noticing plagiarism, mostly self-plagiarism.
Self-plagiarism is when an author reuses the same text or data across multiple books or studies, but presents it as if it's brand new.
So two papers describing ostensibly different samples, but with exactly the same numbers in the tables. Yeah, it got pretty sticky.
Often, the issues the data thugs uncover are just honest mistakes. In those cases, they see no need to publicly call out a scientist. They say it wouldn't be fair or particularly productive.
We very rarely find ourselves in a position where you analyze a paper and say, that's fraud. That almost never happens. You don't know that. And there's a huge distinction between someone made a mistake dragging and dropping a column in Excel versus someone made the study up completely.
Based on the blog post alone, it was clear that the problems with Brian's research went far beyond a simple Excel mistake. Still, the data thugs decided it was best to raise their concerns privately. They reached out to Brian and to Cornell with what they'd found. At first, Brian seemed open to the conversation, but before long, the dialogue stalled. So the data thugs ultimately went public, in part because other scientists were building their work on top of these flawed studies.
We started writing about it, we started blogging about it. I was writing one a week and someone said, oh, it's Wansink Wednesday.
Nick's Wansink Wednesday posts and the growing online chatter eventually forced Cornell to launch an internal investigation. When it wrapped, the university acknowledged problems with the data, but stopped short of calling it scientific misconduct. Still, Nick and the data thugs weren't ready to back down. By mid-2017, they'd flagged nearly 50 papers with potential issues, and the list kept growing. But despite the mounting evidence, nothing was being done. That changed when the story burst into public view, and major news outlets started paying attention.
Hey parents, we all know summer break is for fun, but it's also a time when kids can start losing some of the progress they made during the school year. We want them to stay engaged and keep those young minds active. Between camps, vacations, and family time, it can be tough to keep a learning routine going. That's why I want to tell you about IXL. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized interactive learning that adapts to each child's level and pace. It's an easy way to keep learning going through the summer and helps kids feel confident heading into the next school year. Studies show kids who use IXL score higher on tests, proven in all 50 states. And get this, IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. That's a huge endorsement. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
The easiest thing you'll ever do is keep your car serviced with Roda.
That's a real 5-star Google review from Diana S. And honestly, she nailed it. Roda is the DMV's most trusted auto shop. Maintenance, repairs, and detailing with free valet pickup and drop-off, no hidden fees and no pressure. Book in minutes at Roda.com and save 20% with code POD20. It's Roda. Duh.
The data thugs had hit a wall. Cornell had closed its investigation without labeling Brian's research as scientific misconduct. And Brian had stopped responding to them altogether. Meanwhile, his findings continued to spread, seeping into the media and popular culture unchecked.
by spring of 2017, summer of 2017, there are still all these papers at this point that Nick and his colleagues had been looking at.
That's Stephanie Lee, who you heard at the beginning of the episode. At the time, she was a science reporter at BuzzFeed News.
They had a list of like 50 papers that they had questions about, and they were just sitting out there in the literature. And so to me, I thought, is this really the end of the story?
So after seeing what the data thugs had uncovered, Stephanie was determined to dig deeper and to find new ways into the story.
I thought it'd be really illuminating possibly to see the emails that this lab was exchanging among itself.
Stephanie wanted a look inside the lab to understand what kinds of conversations were happening behind closed doors. Normally, that's where public records requests come in. But there was a problem. Cornell is a private university, which means it's exempt. Still, Stephanie was a savvy reporter, and she found a workaround. She knew Brian had collaborated with researchers at public universities across the country, places that were subject to records requests. So she cast a wide net and filed requests at multiple schools.
It became very clear looking at these emails that there was really like a blatant disregard for careful scientific practice.
Almost immediately, it was clear the data thugs were onto something big. And the deeper Stephanie dug, the more obvious it was. Brian's lab wasn't driven by the pursuit of science, but by the pursuit of headlines and publications.
There is a very explicit theme running throughout these emails of, we need to publish studies that have cool headlines, that have cool findings. Let's analyze the experiments we did until we get something usable. We need to publish as much as possible. Studies that just sit on our desk are like inventory that hasn't been shipped. We need to think like Apple. We need to ship our science out to the world as much as possible. There was overt discussion of like gross statistical manipulation of so many of the experiments they'd conducted.
To confirm she was interpreting things correctly, Stephanie ran these emails by some scientists.
One expert I talked to at the time and asked him what he thought of the correspondence, he said, this is not science, this is storytelling.
That's a pretty damning assessment of the lab's research. And the lab's response was not exactly reassuring.
I got back a bunch of emails from them talking about, we're under attack, we're under siege. People want to know what happened with these papers. We can't find the data. Do you have the data? And so it just showed them scrambling and trying to defend themselves. In some cases, they were talking about studies that were going to be retracted or had problems that we didn't know about publicly yet. Or they were talking about studies that were being questioned but had much deeper problems that they were talking about behind the scenes.
Armed with her interviews and research, Stephanie began publishing her findings. Over the next year, she wrote 14 articles about Brian and the Food and Brain Lab. And as public attention grew, more and more of Brian's papers came under scrutiny. Then, in the spring of 2018, nearly a year and a half after Brian's blog post, a wave of his papers were either retracted or corrected. At that point, Cornell had little choice but to reopen its investigation. Issues with their most well-known lab could easily risk their reputation as a research institution. And in September 2018, Cornell announced its findings. Here's Nick reading from the final report.
Statement: Cornell's investigation found that Professor Wansink committed academic misconduct under our policy. The committee found the practices identified included data falsification, a failure to ensure data accuracy and integrity, inappropriate attribution of authorship,
Brian was removed from all research and teaching duties at Cornell, though he continued to help review his published papers. Then, in June 2019, he resigned from the university altogether. But as Stephanie points out, this isn't just the story of one bad apple. It's part of a much bigger problem.
Traditionally, the behavior that gets rewarded in academia is to publish a lot of research in a pretty short amount of time. Research that gets funding, that gets media attention, and there is a general focus, many scholars would say, on quantity over quality. that can be one big factor when you are trying to get hired somewhere or you're trying to get tenure at a university. You can say, look at all these studies I've done. I'm so productive.
For many researchers, the easiest path to success is publishing as much as possible, especially studies that are flashy and grab media attention. That kind of visibility boosts a university's reputation and helps bring in funding. Seen through that lens, Brian was just playing the game, since the incentives built into modern science push researchers in that direction. Here's James Heathers, one of the data thugs.
There's nothing to prevent me. Nothing except the social reputation of being able to do this, to go next year and to just publish 50 separate scientific papers on whatever I feel like, or very definitely questionable forms of accuracy. If I did that, absolutely no one could stop me.
And when things work that way, the consequences can be far-reaching.
Part of the collective distrust in science now is built out of entirely legitimate stories that describe scientists behaving in an untrustworthy fashion. And I have said for many years that there will be a reckoning of this. And given the present political environment and the collective skepticism, a lot of which, of course, has nothing to do with this, but this is far from helping. I think there's now an environment where really punitive and damaging things could happen.
So what's the harm if someone eats off a smaller plate, believing it'll help them feel full? Probably not much. But for Nick, James, and the other data thugs, this battle isn't just about one researcher. It's part of the much larger war against bad science.
There's a scene at the end of Saving Private Ryan. Tom Hanks' character is badly wounded. He's going to die.
We'll take it. You fall back. You'll be right behind us.
He's up against a wall. The German tanks are counterattacking. And Tom Hanks is a man of duty. And his standing orders are that he must continue to engage the enemy with all means available. And all he's got is his service revolver. He takes this revolver and he starts shooting it at the tank. He's got six shots here. And as he fires the sixth shot, the tank explodes. And he sort of looks slightly bemused for half a second as to how he's managed to blow up this tank with, you know, a revolver. And then these two American B-51s go over, which have just blown the tank up with rockets. I like to think of myself a little bit as, you know, yeah, we've got to go through this. And, you know, there are times you've got to write to editors and you know that nothing much will happen. And just occasionally someone blows up the tank.
Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast. This episode was written and reported by Ian Mont. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont, Elliot Adler, and me, Margot Gray. Our executive producers and story editors are Maddie Sprungkaiser and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil and Andy Jaskowitz. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman, J.D. Crowley, Leah Reese-Dennis, Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Hilary Schuff, Sean Cherry, Laura Berman, and Hilary Van Ornum. Original theme music by James Waterman and Davey Sumner. If you have tips or story ideas, write to us at campusfilespod@gmail.com.
This is the sound of captivity. This is the sound of rescue. And this is the sound of freedom. Give Armenia's captive bears a second chance by supporting International Animal Rescue. Call 508-826-1083 or search The Great Bear Rescue to learn more.